That's fun.
I see. And but I didn't, as you see, I didn't prepare a long catalog of questions, but just, I got very interested in you when I saw that you were the lawyer of Mercedes. I don't know if I pronounced it correctly.
Mercedes Haefer.
Mercedes Haefer. Yeah. Yeah. And then I just I googled you and saw your very diverse background, diverse in terms of like the topics that you worked on, and I had somehow the feeling that it's that you defend people who, like the state enemies of the U.S. or people who get attacked by this big state, and just individuals sometimes in more subcultural contexts.
Yeah, I've been doing this for, and it's funny because I look at Mercedes and I see myself as a young person, although was much more sophisticated, analytical, political, and probably daring than I was at her age. But it, I've been doing this either, in my last life as a human being before I was a lawyer. I was a community organizer and very much involved in a lot of international resistance movements. And so whether it's as a 16-year-old fighting against Vietnam, or whether it's been as a community organizer, or whether it's been as a lawyer for 30 years, I have pretty much declared my own war against the United States and the West in a lot of places. In fact, the reason I just came back from Gaza is I have represented the leadership of Hamas for 17 years. I had to go to see, there's a lot going on with the movement right now, and folks wanted my opinion on certain things, so I had to go to, since they left Syria, I had to travel to a number of places to see a number of different leaders. So, but it was good. I represented, done work for Hezbollah and the IRA and Shining Path and people alleged to connect with Al-Qaeda and work in Yemen and in your own country many years ago. I represented some people in the Red Brigade. Was it the Red Brigade? The Red Brigade? No, not that. That was... what was the movement in Germany?
RAF?
Yeah, but what was it? What was it stretched to?
Okay, Rote Armee Fraktion.
Yes. Yeah. Years ago.
Okay, whom did you represent?
I don't even remember. I was asked as a consultant because at that time, the United States, there were some folks that were in custody in Germany, and the United States was considering trying to extradite them for involvement in attacks on an American military base. Yeah. So I was called by some German attorneys and served as a consultant, and it never got that far. Yeah. But. Bayer Magdorf. It's been a long journey.
Okay, so but if you start with these details, it makes me very interesting and to get the whole image. Where did you grow up and how did you mean your political engagement just came from?
Well, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Come here. I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s against the backdrop of Vietnam. I grew up
In which area in the U.S.?
Not far from, 20 miles from New York City.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. At 16, I essentially ran away from home and moved to New York City and never looked back.
Was your family, they weren't as leftist as you were?
No, I consider my father was a very quiet and withdrawn. He'd had a very difficult experience, a series of experiences in World War II, and it shaped his life. And so he pretty much stayed to himself, but gave me the freedom to do what I wanted to do in ways that I wanted to do it. My mother, on the other hand, who I like to call as an old FDR Democrat, believed very strongly that individuals had the ability to make differences and make changes, and they had a responsibility to impact upon their world. And not necessarily from any collective sense of politics or struggle or resistance, but as a young person seeing my mother just write letters to the President of the United States. The President's, sure, Mom, the President's waiting for your letter and he's going to answer it and send it back. So against that backdrop, and also a backdrop of a lot of books, a lot of reading, a lot of writing, a lot of discussion. Off I went to New York during the Vietnam War era, and if you're young and it's Vietnam, and as I told the federal judge who once said to me, we were in chambers, he's a colonel in the reserves, a good guy, close friend of mine, so to speak, as close as I can get to a federal judge, I guess. And I was sitting there in chambers with a federal prosecutor who's an ex-Marine, who actually ended up being a pretty good guy. And the judge said, Stanley, you're old enough. Did you fight? Were you in Vietnam? And I said, sure. And he said, which front? Where? I said, the domestic front. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me like, oh, you were one of them. Mm-hmm. So, I went from that to, the United States has something called the VISTA, which is the domestic alternative to the Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. And after first university, I got my undergraduate degree, I went into VISTA and spent a year or so living among the Winnebago, Monsanto, Sioux, Native American tribes around the time of Wounded Knee, which also identified and re-identified my politics. And then came back east and did community organizing in a poverty program that ended up the subject of a major federal investigation for some people who worked for me were involved in the Brinks robbery where two cops were killed, and eventually went to law school and was a public defender for 7 or 8 years in the South Bronx in New York, and from there I went off in my own private practice, and 20 plus years later here I am.
And what did motivate you to do community work? Did you believe in a change via this, like, I had this field work in the end?
Well, I'll give you an example. I recently was taking a train ride to New York City, from New York to Washington, D.C. And there was a United States Senator, Frank Lautenberg, who, when he had retired 10 years or so ago, he's come back. We did a number of talk shows together. And I was walking down the aisle, and Senator Lautenberg looked at me and said, Cohen. And I said, hey, Senator, how are you? So he said, come on, sit down. He was having lunch or breakfast or whatever, and he told his young assistant to leave us alone. And we got to talking, and he said, we hadn't seen each other in a while. So he looked at me and he said, Stanley, how are your friends in Hamas? And I said, Senator, what are you doing tonight, tomorrow? He looked at me. He said, why? I said, let's go to the airport, get on a plane, we'll fly to Syria. You can sit down and talk to my friends in Hamas. No one will know. You talk to them, ask the questions you want to ask, discuss the issues you want. So he looked at me, and it really sort of took him aback, and he said, forever the diplomat, to me. Mm-hmm. And my response to the senator was, I learned very, very many years ago as a young student activist that the art of diplomacy is much too important to be left to the diplomats. Mm-hmm. So at a very young age, I developed a very keen sense of resistance. It was at a crossroad of dramatic cultural, political, social, sexual, economic change in the world. Not just, we in the United States all too often think we're the center of the world. But the entire world was in a state of flux and revolution. And I grew up in that period. And at a young age, I decided that I could be, I hate to use the anecdote, but either part of the solution or part of the problem or part of the solution. Mm. And decided to become part of the solution. Mm. I've been very blessed because in the course of my life, I've come across periodically some truly magnificent human beings that have been inspirational to me. My godfather was a fairly famous West Indian trade union activist who started the Communist Party in the West Indies with Manley's father, and then his mother had to put him on a boat because the British were going to kill him. He was my mentor as a young man for a number of years. Mm-hmm. My real inculcation or development and growth in the Middle East was spawned as a result of my representing Musa Abu Marzouk, who's the head of the political wing of Hamas and probably soon to become the head of the entire organization. That's 1995, although I had certainly not supported Israeli expansion and was sensitive to Palestinian resistance and exploitation by Israel and Zionism long before I met Musa. Mm-hmm. You know, 1995, Musa was in jail for 22 or 23 months, and I visited with him probably four nights a week, 3 hours a night for almost 2 years. That's a lot of talking. Mm-hmm. We have a passion in history and political science and organizing, and he's truly one of the great people in the world today. So we became very close and great friends, and this is who I just came back from seeing. And that was sort of a segue into a completely different level of resistance for me in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And from there, you know, when you successfully represent Abu Marzouk and you become involved, your practice.
Yeah.
So I've spent a good chunk of, in particular, the last 17 years involved in the Middle East.
Yeah. Probably in terms of your, considering your success as a lawyer and so on, you could have decided differently, and as so many people who were engaged in the 60s just made big careers afterwards and forgot their ideals. And when I googled you and I did some research, I found sites where you were attacked and so on, so there could have been easier ways. What did constantly engage you or motivate your resistance?
Well, there's two different, it's a funny, first let me comment on your first part of you, and I'll answer your question.
Yeah.
I recently ran into someone, I was with the Legal Aid Society in the South Bronx many, many years ago, in Florida. I was coming on a plane, coming back from a case in Florida, and I said, so how's your practice going? And he was not, I was a much better lawyer than him, a trial attorney. Mm. And he said, I quit law about 10, 12 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. I said, really? What are you doing? And he said, I own a chain of restaurants. He had gone to Wall Street after Legal Aid. I had been offered a job in Wall Street. And probably by now, I would have been fat and bored and owned a chain of restaurants in Italy or whatever. And it's not without its cost. The United States government has been investigating and trying to prosecute me for 20 years. There is I don't know. It's interesting because when I look back, there are points in my life where inexplicably I could have gone in one way or I could have gone in another way. I could have gone in this direction. I could have gone in that direction. And something within me maybe go one way, which led to something else, which led to something else. So although, I'm not a theist, I'm a fairly spiritual person. Spiritual not from the standpoint of the Far East that I think that, there are divine forces that are directing me, but I think there are inexplicably things affect us in ways we don't fully understand. I come from a tradition of resistance. I come from a family of, in their own way, fighters. I lost family in World War II. I've lost family.
You have a Jewish family?
Yeah.
And did they emigrate, or had they already lived in the U.S. before?
It's interesting because my grandfather was belonged to an anarchist collective in pre-Russia called the Narodniks. Mm-hmm. And the Narodniks were a group of young pre-Trotskyite precursor movement that literally attacked the Tsar's family just as a political statement. And there was some discussion in my family as a young man that my grandfather as a young man had actually been involved in killing a member of the Tsar's family. They would stop them, shoot them, rob them. So as a young man, he was put on a boat, and as was the grandfather on the other side of the family, and they were sent to Africa. Mm-hmm. And one family went to South Africa, the other family went to Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, where they stayed for about 10 or 15 years. One remained. Mm-hmm. And then the other emigrated to the United States.
In South Africa, there is still...
I've got one cousin left in South... An interesting story, my cousin in South Africa, who I've not seen in many years, she at one point emigrated to Israel. And she fell in love with an Israeli, or I don't know which came first, married him, lasted 2 years, was so appalled by the apartheid system of it's funny when a South African says, I was so appalled by apartheid Israeli style, she left her husband and moved back to South Africa.
From one apartheid to the other.
That's correct. But in her position, she would rather live in a system where the majority truly dictated policy as opposed to the minority. So, you know, there have been crossroads. There have been periods in my life. I'm involved in a very intense battle with the United States government right now where they're threatening to arrest me. And they may, and they may not, and it really doesn't matter. Because I have a very keen understanding that when you resist the powerful, the rules of the game change. As long as you're very passive and compliant, it's fine. So sure, I could have made decisions to go in different directions in different ways at different times. I had no interest. It was never, you know, it's funny, it's a funny story. You're talking about the collective you're working, or the piece you're working, your doctoral thesis. I had dinner last night with an old friend of mine who is an anarchist squatter who, the Lower East Side of Manhattan 20 years ago was a hotbed of resistance, the Tompkins Square Park, the 13th Street squatter cases, the homeless park, the shelter, huge wars in the Lower East Side. We met about 25 years ago, 24 years ago. I was walking down the street, I ran into a lawyer, he was busy, he said these folks have some problems, I talked to Sarah. The next thing you know, I agreed that night to go with Sarah to the local police station where 200 people had been arrested to see what I could do. Okay. So we're sitting around and talking last night, having dinner, and we're coming back down the block, and we crossed a corner, and the police wouldn't let us come through, and it was deja vu. There were several hundred police officers. And so naturally, if the police say you're not allowed to go somewhere, you know that's where you have to go. So we turned around, we snuck around the corner, we came up, and there had been a police attack on the anarchist bookstore on 6th Street, which is a spin-off of the Occupy Wall Street movement. There was a demonstration yesterday in Manhattan where there had been some arrests. So Sarah said to me, you want to go to the precinct? So 25 years, 24 years later, we went back to the same precinct, and there was the next generation, 19-year-old kids in jail bleeding with the support team looking at me, and one of them said, you're that lawyer. And I said, okay, I'm that lawyer. And they said, I've really admired you for many, many years. It's a pleasure. I'm proud that I had to get arrested to meet you or something like that. So, and there it was, 25 years later, back in the same precinct, the same person doing the same thing.
But probably you also, or do you sometimes also feel like, where do you see menace as French, I think, like in danger when you go outside, just are there people who try to who attack you directly after September 11th?
Yeah, there were. Look, I spend extensive time in the Middle East. I've lost, I don't know how many dozens of friends of mine have been assassinated by Israel or the United States, have been tortured, beaten. Not a day goes by where I don't learn of a friend, a comrade, a colleague, a client getting harassed or killed. Families just. I'm used to it. Post 9/11, I had to have some security for a while because we were so fucking out of our minds for a couple of years. You do what you do. I live in a tough neighborhood. This is a Latino neighborhood. It's the Lower East Side. I've never had any problems down here. The biggest problems I tend to have is college students throwing up on me when they're too drunk. I was indicted in Canada 20 years ago for seditious conspiracy when I represented a bunch of Mohawk Indians in a standoff with Quebec and the Canadian Army. I almost got shot there. I got arrested by the Canadian Army. I was in jail for 3 weeks at that point. So it's... I'm pretty adept, I'm pretty smart, I get around, I spend a lot of time in cultures where there are a lot of guns, a lot of violence, a lot of anger. You have to be smart, but you can't allow concerns about your personal safety to overcome or overwhelm the politics.
And do you have family here? Or?
I have... essentially, the only family that I have left in the world is a significant other of 16 years who is a North American Indian, who I spoke to this morning, who's an artist who lives in Florida half the year. Parents are deceased. I have an older brother who I haven't talked to in 7 years, who became a born-again fundamentalist Baptist minister. Is this too loud? I can lower this.
Oh, it's okay.
I have, a small circle of friends and a small circle of My girlfriend's family is much more my family than my own.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I've got some cousins I really don't see much of. I apparently have a cousin who's quite a young and upcoming songwriter and musician that I heard about on the radio recently and was kind of amazed. I said, gee, I think that's my cousin. I have friends in a lot of places.
Yeah. And so your engagement with the Hamas, as far as I got to know it right now, I would say that it's nearly based on coincidences that you so much got into the Middle East situation or thing. And but what is for you, what is the most interesting thing about it?
Well, I have a very strong feeling that the issue, the question, the resistance, the war in Palestine and in Israel can only be resolved internally among Semitic people, among Jews and Arabs, among Palestinians and Israelis. I think the notion that the West in general, or the United States in particular, can serve as mediators when we are so clearly partisan, when we have armed Israel and blindly supported Israel and provided weapons of mass destruction that have been used routinely, when we have supported extrajudicial assassination and collective punishment, when we have vetoed United Nations resolutions, when we have refused to recognize the International Criminal Court as such, that for whatever reason I found myself in the position where I have many influential friends in the Middle East, in particular in the Muslim and particularly in the Islamist world. Fortunately, a lot of folks respect me. I am fairly opinionated. I've spent a lot of time in the region. For whatever reason, I found myself in a position where I could give opinion and advice from a Western perspective on how issues are seen, what can be dealt to deal with them, how they should be approached. The story with Abu Marzouk and Hamas is simple. I had just spent a six-week trial on the 13th Street squatter case, a bunch of empty buildings that squatters had taken for 8 years at that point. And we had been fighting to keep them. And I was also representing Muslims from Kosovo then. It was before the United States got involved in the siege in Sarajevo. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from a Muslim client of mine in Washington, D.C. on a Friday night when I was getting ready to go on holiday. I was exhausted. And he said to me, listen, there's a very significant person who's been stopped coming back to the United States at the airport, and could you really just go over and see if he's okay? And I said, no, I'm too tired, I'm going on holiday, my then girlfriend will murder me, we've been planning on going away for months, we have a cabin on Maine, you know, I said, well, who's the guy, or the person? He said, Musa Abu Marzouk. I said, yeah, all right, well, tell Mr. Marzouk my regards. So he said, I really think you should go. And I said, well, What's so compelling? I'm tired. I'm on holiday. He said, well, you may have heard of the organization which he heads. And I said, what's that? He said, it's Hamas. I went, oh. He said, all right, let me take a run over to the jail. And it was the early stages. It was actually the year before Hamas became a designated terrorist organization.
When was it?
1995.
Okay.
And it was just around the time of the first intifada, and it was before the first series of so-called suicide operations.
Yeah.
And so I went to the jail, and I showed up, and I walked in, and, you know, my hair was brown then, and wilder and crazier, and my beard was fuller, and I was, you know, I had jeans on and boots, and I walked in, and I said hello to this gentleman, and he looked at me, and I said a certain phrase that my friend had said, tell him such and such, and he'll be okay. And he looked at me, and he said, who are you? And I said, I'm a lawyer. And he did head down, head up, head down. He said, you're a lawyer? I said, yeah. He said, I don't need a lawyer. I said, you're right, you need 10 lawyers. So we became, it was all coincidental. I didn't go on holiday. My girlfriend left me shortly thereafter. We became famous friends, so much so that his two of his oldest children who remained in the United States when he was deported to Jordan, I pretty much raised. They lived in Washington, but whenever there was a problem, I dealt with them. It was the parent figure in their life. And I just was in, I saw Musa in November in Syria, and then I just saw him by 4 days. I was in Cairo with him. Mm-hmm. And it's actually interesting because we have the kind of relationship, we're the same age basically, that I needed to ask his opinion on some personal issues. So he enjoyed the switch. Mm-hmm. Because I had gone to Gaza, come back, and I was getting ready to leave, and I said, I really need to talk to you for 10 minutes. I need to ask your advice on something. Yeah. He said, oh, come right over. So I came over, and we had a very long talk about a very significant issue, and he gave me his advice. I followed it, although I think I may have made a mistake. But
probably, or what would you say, if you yourself were a Muslim, if you didn't live in the U.S., if you were born in Syria, would you then still be the big lawyer of Hamas right now?
I'd probably be dead. If I, there is no doubt in my mind, given my politics and given my view of history, if I were Palestinian, I would have walked into a bus in Tel Aviv 15 years ago and blown myself up. I do not, the issue of resistance is such as, so many people are amazed over the nature and extent of resistance among Palestinian young, and my question is, I'm shocked that there's not more.
The reason for my question, or it's more, about your current situation can only be described in the whole framework of your biography, of your situation, or your relationship to the U.S. and mm-hmm. Hamas and Muslims or the Islam is the underdogs here in the U.S., but it's not the underdogs in Palestine for sure, but in certain parts of the Middle East, it's the majority or the powerful people there.
Well, you know, the West has traditionally been able to control the narrative of the Middle East, despite the fact we've been a distinct minority. Between our money and our guns, and between our arrogance and our abuse, we've never refrained from creating countries, destroying countries, and murdering people. Always for the best of reasons. You know, we Americans always do everything for the best of reasons because we're empowered and endeared to do that. I don't do as much work in the Islamic community in the United States as I once did. Post 9/11, for about a solid 5 years, I was probably the loudest voice in terms of the left, in terms of lawyers in this country representing Palestine. And I still do terrorism cases in this country. I've got 3 pretty much now, right now. But those are pure criminal defense cases. I was probably one of the most outspoken persons because most of my profession, even the left, you know, crawled into caves and wouldn't say a word because it was un-American and they were intimidated. So I felt obligated to sort of beat the hustings, speak out, be the iconoclast, challenge the traditional values, and to speak with determination on behalf of a large Islamic community in this country. I made a conscious decision to stop that. Part of it was conscious, part of it was not. The conscious decision was, I almost became for a while a caricature. I was spending a lot of time doing television and doing radio and doing debates and discussions. 5 minutes, 8 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 minutes, just enough to stir up the pot, but not enough to really facilitate in-depth discussion and analysis, and it became crazy, and I walked away. Also, the Islamic community in the United States, the Muslim community, has been under siege for so long that I became somewhat of an outcast even within the community because my politics were too radical for the community.
Yeah.
The community wanted to distance itself from Hamas. The community wanted to distance itself from Hezbollah. The community wanted to distance itself from armed struggle. The community wanted to wear big American flags and be very conservative, but the community is a very conservative community to begin with. Islam is steeped in conservatism. So the combination of my own conscious decision, as well as it being in the best interest of the Islamic community in the United States, I spend less and less and less time in terms of the Muslim community here, and gravitated naturally overseas increasingly, where there's a very different struggle going on.
Yeah.
And even though you're talking about an area of the world where Islam, whether it's Sunni or Shia, represents a majority of the body politic, except for Lebanon, the region, the narrative of the region is still very much being directed, dictated, and controlled by the West, despite superior numbers and despite history and tradition and politics. The Gulf is a little bit different, but sure. So it's an interesting point where I'll run across, there were events in the United States sponsored by Muslim groups, Islamic groups, where in the old days I'd get invited regularly. And I no longer am. I'm just not. One of the most powerful Muslim advocacy groups in the United States, the leader who I've known for many, 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 many years, you know, I made a public statement, and I understood why, but it sort of created a schism between us, that he had decided that Hamas was a terrorist organization. And after I heard that, I said, well, you go your way, I'll go mine, and maybe I won't tell people that your organization was started with money by people that founded Hamas. So shall we just call it a day? But now the interesting thing is, as Abu Marzouk said, you know, Hamas is getting a lot of heat both internally and externally, because in some quarters they're being seen as much too conciliatory and much too peaceful at this point. That the armed struggle with them has shifted very much to a different sort of dynamic.
Talking about this Western perspective, or that still dominates the whole imaginary, that makes me think about Anonymous, because I'll start from behind now with Anonymous, because in certain ways I think a critical approach towards like the somehow also imperialist notion of some ideas of Anonymous, like let's bring freedom to everybody in the world, let's free the Egyptian people and bring them our democracy. That's somehow the same discourse that circulates within Anonymous posts and the videos that also is very much implied by the Americans, or it's a very neoliberal discourse and so on. What would you are the lawyer of Anonymous right now, so.
Well, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy, because the so-called Arab Spring, which has been, which I've called the Arab Autumn, for a variety of reasons, was sort of hijacked by the arrogance of the West, where it has been interpreted, viewed, seen by many in the West as, quote, uprisings in which particularly young women and men in the Arab, North African, perhaps Gulf world are throwing out the old because they want to become more American. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. It is a very much pan-Arab nationalist independence movement with its roots going back to Nasser, in which it's like, look, we are the Middle East. We are 5,000 years old. We do not need IBM, Google, or anyone else to tell us how to live, how to think, or how to act. And besides, every time we embrace your notion of democracy, as in the most democratic elections in the history of the Middle East and Palestine, and Hamas wins, you go, whoops, we don't recognize that democracy. And in fact, I gave a lecture in the Gaza Strip a discussion to a small group of students from the Islamic University, particularly a couple of young Muslim women, who asked the question about how do we best express the events in our world. And I said, well, I can't tell you how best to express it, but the one thing everyone needs to say right out of the box is, this ain't about more McDonald's. This is not about a BMW. This is not about a weekend holiday at Las Vegas. We've got to make sure that your revolution, good, bad, and different, remains your revolution. And it's not designed to become Las Vegas.
But what about the role of Anonymous within it? Because Anonymous, some videos say, and whoever created these videos say, it's our responsibility that Egypt is free now.
Well, look, I've had this discussion with revolution, resistance, and armed struggle is very much an evolutionary process. You give me a 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 25-year-old who believes in a world community and a world struggle, I may disagree with her or him about the politics. Egypt was not a revolution, but a military coup. We now see yesterday the military decided three candidates, one of whom should not have been able to, can't run. So I've had discussions with so-called anonymous members, leaders, activists about, listen, it's a good thing to try to play an active role in facilitating the aspirations of individuals worldwide. It's a good thing to be able to serve as a counterweight to the state and its ability to control communication, discussion, debate, and narrative. Don't confuse the notions of liberation and armed struggle or resistance with we're one big happy world community. On the other hand, I mean, Mercedes herself takes a very, you know, internationalist position and says, look, you know, I am the future. The world is mine. That means with that benefit comes a tremendous responsibility. To the degree that I am a member of the world community, to the degree that I have certain skills, to the degree that I have certain aspirations, I will use that and commit those with sisters and brothers of all ages, of all religions, of all perspectives worldwide to try to fight the state, no matter where the state may be, no matter what the state may constitute. How those people choose to redefine their state is up to them. That's a fine position. That's a wonderful position. It's a position I tried to live as a 20-year-old, and she is living as a 20-year-old now. Some of the so-called anonymous movement, because anonymous, you know, people opt in, they opt out, they opt in, they opt. One day I'm anonymous, one day I'm not anonymous, one day I'm anonymous, one. You know, Sabu, the big arrested, he's a kid from three blocks from here who I've known since he's 13 years old.
But you don't defend him as well?
Well, no, there's a funny story about him, and, you know, we'll go there and then we'll come back. Maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago, his aunt, who was a former client of mine, came up to me in the street and she said, oh, my nephew's got huge problems. They're fucking with him over this anonymous shit. And I said, nephew? And I said, yeah, right. She said, no, they're talking about 125 years in jail. He needs to talk to you. I said, no problem. I'll talk to him, but, you know, I'm representing someone in Hamas in Northern California. I can't represent him, so let him. So I ran into him in the street about 3 weeks later. He said, Stanley, I got this problem. This is what's going on. I didn't believe it. It was my own sort of insular hang-up about the community, about him, about his family. They're a family of heroin dealers. That's how I've known him forever. And at some point, this kid developed some politics, which at some point also got distilled and fucked up and it went off in other directions. And I was stunned. And then when the whole big, you know, LASAC bust came down and he was outed as Sabu, I saw his aunt yesterday, who I've known forever. And then I ran into him, and he's like, I told you. And I said, what the fuck? So that was an interesting story.
But is he in jail now?
No. He's cooperating.
But so that means he's back at home now.
I don't know if he's in the neighborhood. Yeah. He's cooperating. He's assisting the government. He's going to be a witness. I don't know if he'll be a witness in my case.
But he was aggressed from the anonymous community for doing that now.
Yeah. So, look. Anonymous is a look. You know, it's great to look. There are 14-year-old kids in Chicago that say they're anonymous. Right? They love computers. Independent of their political development, of their political evolution, they're 14-year-old kids going through puberty, going through all the crazy shit. You know, they're great on computers. They like fucking with power. They have problems with their parents. You know, and it ranges from them to 70-year-olds in veteran hospitals who are fighting back because their life has been wretched and because the government around them and the governments around them have fucked with their lives and their families and their communities and their people's lives. They're anonymous. And anonymous are college students. And anonymous are activists. And anonymous are potheads. And anonymous are, you know, models, male and female, that make a lot of money walking on the runway. But there's a need, a yearning in their life to fight back for whatever reason. It represents fairly developed, sophisticated political analysis. It also represents fairly undeveloped, unsophisticated, fuck you, I don't like your power. It's a lot, it's a little, it's everything. The beauty of the movement is it does two things. I mean, there's more than two beauties, but there are two things that are particularly compelling about it. And I draw parallels to the, it's interesting, to the Palestinian-Israeli narrative. The West makes a big deal out of Palestinian resistance movements, no matter which the movements are, shooting firecrackers into South Israel. I mean, they're literally firecrackers. There's nothing. You know, maybe an Israeli chokes on a piece of pizza from shock. They carry really little punch. They do very little physical damage. Very few Israelis have been harmed, let alone killed. But what they do is they disrupt the false sense of security that Israel needs to provide to its population to maintain its control. The reason why Israel has survived as Sparta, as a modern-day society of steeped in murder and death and destruction, is its people have been convinced largely, whether they support them or not, you're safe. We are all powerful, we are omnipotent, we are omnipresent. And as long as people believe that, they are willing to defer decision-making to leaders, good, bad, or indifferent. It's an important component. The reason why those Palestinian firecrackers fuck with Israel so much is because it sends a message, the prince has no clothes. Mm-hmm. You can kill us, you can jail us, you can torture us, but you'll never have a day's peace because we're righteous and it's a just resistance. Anonymous, in its own right, does the same thing to the all-powerful Western world in particular. The world that says, you can't beat us, we control the narrative, we've got the best technology, we own the corporations, we own the companies, we control the message, and Anonymous comes along and goes, poof, fuck you, you don't. And no matter how big and smart and powerful and bright you may think you are, my name is X, and I'm a 16-year-old schoolgirl in Iowa who just shut down the fucking CIA. Poof. And that's why Anonymous is all at once so important, and that's why Anonymous is all at once such a heavy target for the government, especially in the West and the United States, because when corporations, when military people, when politicians begin to understand that the prince has no clothes, that their innermost secrets, that their philandering, that their hypocrisy, that their thievery, that their terrible deals with the devil are not secret, it shakes up the process. So that's what's so significant. So you've got two issues. One is Anonymous's ability to disrupt the status quo and the security blanket that controls much of the world, even the developing world today, number one. And number two, the fact that it's breaking down traditional notions that you have to, there's a hierarchical structure, you have to belong to an organization, you vote for the queen of the prom or the king of the prom, you follow certain rules and regimentations, consensus doesn't work, you don't listen to the input or output of other people. To the degree that Anonymous has disrupted that 200-year-old Western body, political body and that thought, it represents a clean break with the past. Yeah. And that's, if nothing else, the two reasons. And, you know, even inadvertently, there are folks in Anonymous doing things. You know, I take a position that, you know, at one time I was insistent that you had to do the right thing for the right reason. I'm perfectly willing at this point of my life to have good results for the wrong reason. I'll take the results. I was having a discussion with someone in Palestine just last week. They asked me what I thought would happen with the election and what I thought the next Obama administration would be. And I said, look, five years ago, when everyone was running around racing that Obama was coming, the world's going to be wonderful, kumbaya, we are the world, you know, all this nonsense, I said, the guy's a scammer, he's a fake, he's a charlatan. He looks good, comes out of the water looking nice, he makes a very good speech, he's a huckster. And everyone said, no. He went to Cairo, he gave a speech, I rolled my eyes, I said, bullshit. The first time he saluted the generals, the very first time, it was crisp, it was appropriate, it was proper. It said to me he had spent 10 hours in the mirror getting training on how to salute the military. First time he did that, the generals looked at each other and said, we got him. And they have. Now, A, I think he's going to win. And B, I think his position on the Middle East, in particular Palestine, will be better. Not the cure-all, not because he wants to, not because for the right reasons, but there's two issues. One, he's concerned about his legacy.
Yeah.
He's a young man, and young men are who run it all the way up the flagpole are concerned about their future. And two, Netanyahu embarrassed him. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to fuck with Netanyahu. So I said, he may turn out to do the right reason, the right thing for the wrong reason. But I don't really care. If it... Mm-hmm. Go ahead, sorry.
No, but, yeah, but what's the wrong reasons with an anonymous? Or what could be?
Well,
there are many reasons.
Wrong reasons? Anonymous as essentially an anarchist movement has a very, to some degree, a Western view of geopolitics. They're breaking through and breaking out, and the reality of it is there are some resistance movements involved in life and death struggle, particularly in the Middle East, that are involved in some very sophisticated, I'm not suggesting it's over the head of Anonymous at all, it's not what I'm saying, are involved in some very sophisticated, fragile negotiations, strategizing, movements, alliances, and that Anonymous, people that consider themselves to be members of Anonymous who opt in, get involved with disrupting communications, discussions, and events on the ground because in their view, it's necessary, and it doesn't necessarily facilitate the good movement. So the fact that Anonymous shut down the Israeli stock market, great. I think it's fucking wonderful. Whatever you can do to the Israeli infrastructure is great. The fact that Anonymous views some Islamist movements as the enemy because of misconceived notions about gender, role, politics, and Islam is not great. The only show in town in the Middle East is Islam. That's where the resistance comes from. So you have to, and I've had this discussion on the internet and also in person with so-called people from Anonymous, it's good to play an active role in charting the course of the history of our world. It's good to facilitate and help. There are times you have to follow, there are times you can take the lead. I have friends of mine, colleagues, comrades, clients, who don't understand the role, the relationship, the position of women in Islam, and have a very skewered view about the need to protect women in the Middle East. You know, my position is protect fucking women in Alabama.
Yeah.
For sure. I have an old client of mine, a Palestinian client, whose wife is a PhD and teaches in California, in Oregon, who's a Sunni, who wears a hijab, who is a classic Middle East quote-unquote woman, who was being interviewed, I'll never forget this, by a Western journalist about 5 or 6 years ago. And he looked at her and he said, "You're bright, you have a PhD, you're articulate, you're charismatic. How do you feel having to look this way or dress this way?" And she looked at him.
Have to?
And she said, she said, "I do what I do out of choice." She said, "B, the real problem is, this is not a problem for me. The problem is you can't see my body. That's what's interfering with you. Because of this, you can't see my hair, you can't see my breasts, you can't see my hips, you cannot see me physically, and you can't handle it. You're stuck with looking at my eyes and listening to my mouth. It's your problem." And he was sort of taken aback. So there's a woman who's fairly active in Occupy Wall Street who we had a big debate this past summer about women who were oppressed in the Middle East. And I said, "Come on, stop. Stop exporting your notion of exploitation and oppression in the region."
But are there, do you know if, I think I could never really figure that out via analyzing the chats or the videos, if there is really, I will go to Egypt and do some field studies there, but that's only in autumn. But are there anonymous groups that try to organize within Egypt and Tunisia? Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, Anonymous has taken on an historical life of its own.
Yeah.
Anyone who is involved in computer debate discussion, anyone who's political, anyone who sees the computer, Twitter, blogs, MySpace, MyFacebook, the whole thing, as an essential component of the 21st century organizing tool, which it is, gravitates to anonymous.
Yeah, sure.
Do I think that, I don't know whether to what extent anonymous actually was able to undo the Egyptian block of the internet. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's grown to legendary proportions. And maybe it really doesn't matter. Maybe the mere fact that people believe it is every bit as important about what they did or did not do.
Exactly.
Everywhere, I was just in Tahrir Square. I was just in Egypt for a week. Everywhere you go are kids with computers, with iPads. But you see, there's something fundamentally... I was in Egypt about 6 months before the revolution, the counter-revolution, the military coup, whatever you want to call it. And I've been to Egypt on many occasions. And I love the Egyptian people. I have many friends who are Egyptian. I never really cared for Egypt, for a lot of reasons, not least of which is Mubarak and Israel and the United States owned Egypt for 30 years. But what I noticed my last trip, the trip before the revolution, was for the first time, people were standing in groups of 6, 8, 10 on street corners with signs, protesting. Never saw that before. And cops were letting them do it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I also noticed were cops were walking, police were walking up the streets asking for money. Give me $3, give me £2, give me a pound, give me a... I knew then that the infrastructure was collapsing.
Yeah.
They were losing control, it was breaking down. I didn't see one laptop, I didn't see one Twitter, I didn't see one BlackBerry, I didn't see one smartphone. I saw people with placards on the street, no longer afraid.
Yeah.
And I said to a friend of mine, who's Ahmed Mansour, who does open borders for Al Jazeera, I said, you know, who's Egyptian? I said, Ahmed, this is about to explode.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's here.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, it's a wonderful time. The fact that there is a 7-year-old kid in Equatorial Africa who to this point has never been more than 100 yards from his village who can open up an iPad and talk to someone in Norway or to see a football game in Germany is remarkable. The world is small.
And then like considering if this girl considers herself then as anonymous and becomes with this name, it's not only like about anonymity, it's also something that unifies this common
Absolutely
name
right.
and so on. So, yeah. But would you yourself, do you like participate in online discussions using the pseudonym Anonymous?
When years ago at around 9/11, I felt obligated to participate in blogs.
Yeah.
And they degenerated to such fucking stupidity that I finally said, leave me alone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the conspiracy theorists were occupying all the blogs where, you know, George Bush blew up, you know, the World Trade Center and, you know, all the craziness. I finally said, enough is enough is enough.
And now, with being a lawyer for Mercedes, you didn't try again.
No.
But, and I would... Yeah, there's still one question that we didn't discuss, or I would love to know what you think about it and also what the development was in court now. That's, I think, one issue that also is a sign of overcoming the old political ontologies that also, like, the law system doesn't work anymore. Probably there mm-hmm. is no real... they don't know how to treat DDoS attacks.
It hasn't evolved. That's true.
Okay. And what's your approach towards it? Or
I'm Maoist in that position. You know, you make coalitions where none exist, and where bad coalitions exist, you disrupt it. I believe whenever, I think there's a cardinal rule of resistance that applies, whether it's for we Westerners who crawled out of the cave 500 years ago, or whether it's Middle Easterners who evolved 6,000 years ago. No matter what the nature of the struggle, no matter what the reason for the struggle, you have to become friction unto the machine. Your job as an advocate is to slow the fucking machine down. Whenever you allow the machine, the machinery of government, the machinery of the courts, the machinery of state, the machinery of military, to run its normal course, you get chewed up, you get spit out. You become fodder for the machine. our jobs as fighters, as activists, as lawyers, as doctors, as, quote, anonymous.
Sorry, can I interrupt? Because I really like what you, and I was just thinking about if, the metaphor machine for it, for a system or something. Then that makes me think about the Luddites, you know, and that's okay. That was really about machines that were, but I think Marx would be proud that anonymous are the new Luddites.
Absolutely.
In a certain way.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. You know, Marx wrote about the necessity of disruption, about disrupting, changing, and breaking the old in order for the new to develop, the new world.
Being exploited by the machines.
Absolutely. And my job, whether as a person or as a lawyer, as an advocate, is to become friction under the machine.
Yeah.
If you allow the machinery of government, of law, of courts, of state to run, you can't win.
Yeah.
It chews you up and spits you out. So the issue of defending anonymous, and you're right, you see, the problem with, you know, whether it's a system of common law or civil law, it's anachronistic. We are always, just when you begin to learn the rules of the game, they change the game. Just when the law begins to catch up with changing needs and exigencies, that changes. So right now you've got prosecutions and rules and laws and applications being applied to DDoS attacks, to discussions, to what is it, what is an intent, what is injury, what is damage, that basically come out of bank robberies that have no real relevance. So judges, for example, we have been fighting for 6 months in anonymous, I've been probably the lead lawyer in this, the whole issue of conditions of release.
Mm.
All right, Mercedes has her laptop, the people have their computers back. What can you do, what can you not do? Can the government monitor what you're doing on the computer? Well, there are First Amendment or free speech issues, and there's privileged communication issues. And it's none of the government's business, you know, what Mercedes' boyfriend or girlfriend that she are talking about. So all these notions, in the old days, you sold a kilo of heroin, you got arrested, you fought your case, did you have the drugs, did you not have the drugs, simple, open and shut.
Yeah.
This is a brave new world, and it creates all new issues. Now me, my view is it doesn't matter it's a brave new world, the job of me as an advocate is to still be fucking friction into the machine, is to be the biggest pain in the ass and to run with it and disrupt it and play with it. Some people call it smoke and mirrors and I call it No Resistance 102.
Yeah.
You have this tension, this friction between the need, the desire, and the ability of the government to dictate the parameter of the struggle, and us, on the other hand, to say, no, you want to play that game by those rules, that's up to you. We're breaking that shit down. Whether it's in the courts, whether it's on the computers, whether it's in the streets, old world, new world. And what I find so interesting about this day is, you know, I said to people, if you had told me 20 or 25 years ago, that we would be where we are at today in this world in terms of military aggression, in terms of our adventurism, in terms of rewriting the era, and I would say not fucking possible. You know, I came out of a generation that rebelled against the 50s, which was, okay, we broke the old bottle.
Yeah.
It's over, it's finished, it's a new world. And we had our run for 20 or 25 years, and unfortunately the only real fundamental revolutionary change came to issues of notions about sexuality, and even then that started to backtrack on us again with the Christianity craziness. And now we're right back to this conservative dogma. And but what's so interesting is there are new rules to the game.
Yeah.
You've got those people in position of power who have re-embraced the old rules of the game, but they're dealing with new tools, and the new tools they can't understand and use. So I guess history is a process of dialectical materialism repeating itself, and just the faces change, but the struggle continues.
Yeah.
That ultimately is why I think Mercedes and I, you know, it's a funny story, but I got a call about 6-7 months before Mercedes got arrested by an anarchist friend of mine who said, listen, you know Anonymous? I said, yeah, I. All right. There have been a series of grand jury subpoenas and search warrants executed all over the country. There's about 6, 7, 8 largely young kids. Don't know what the fuck to do, don't know what their rights are, don't know how to deal with it, don't know how to proceed. Will you talk to them? Sure. I spent a couple of days on the telephone talking to people about basic, your rights, your obligations, grand jury. I spoke to federal prosecutors. I told agents. And it was fine. And then Mercedes and I sort of hit it off. Not just because she's incredibly bright and independent, but she's a fucking wise ass. She's a sarcastic fucking wise ass. And I gravitate to sarcastic wise asses. As she told me early on, you know, I asked her how did she survive in Arkansas, where she came from as a young woman. She said, I made believe I was a lesbian from the time I was 10, and it drove everyone fucking nuts. She was interesting. So there was a documentary being done. And so she came to New York, they brought her in, and she said, you know, there's a document, what do you think? I said, well, I got some problems. So she said, well, would you go to the shooting with me? Sort of let me know where to go, not to go. I don't really want to fuck things up. So I said, sure. So she showed up. She walked in this elevator with a Hollywood producer one day, took one look, and she said, oh, you're my lawyer. And I said, well, I wouldn't go that far. So we spent a couple of days, and then she was sitting here, and she said, listen to me. If I get arrested, will you represent me? So I looked at her and I said, you mean when you get arrested? I said, this is no if. I said, you're getting arrested. So I said, sure. So the rest is history. You know, we go through these, you know, it's funny. She says that the collective has voted me as the coolest lawyer in the case. And I said, well, that doesn't necessarily mean a lot. You'd be better off with the best lawyer in the case, not the coolest lawyer in the case. You know, I think she's great. I think she's fabulous. I think the world is a much better place because of Mercedes.
In terms of, we were just discussing this old system doesn't have, or like they don't know how to treat as far as I understood right now, it's not even clarified if they are allowed to get the data from the computers or not, and so on.
Well, we're fighting over access, and now we're involved in a whole issue where the government has to return a lot of stuff that they're not entitled to have. Here's the problem. The government has spent millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars in building a case and developing a case, and it's not a case. You know, you have to, even if you apply the law as it exists, the law talks about you have to damage in excess of $5,000 a protected computer network. PayPal got up and said, you didn't touch us. They filed documents with the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission. They held press conference. You didn't touch us. We're all powerful. No one can touch us. So now they claim they've lost $5.3 million. Where did the $5.3 million come from? Well, as a result of the DDoS attack, they've now spent $5.3 million in upgrading their security system. Now, Mercedes' position is, fuck them, I should send them a bill for services.
Yeah, exactly.
If I did what you said I did, and I'm not conceding you did, then the best thing that ever happened to you guys is we put you on notice on how bullshit your system is. So, it's this sort of hanging out there. And, you know, it's the specter of a 65, 70-year-old federal judge who's used to certain kinds of cases, and prosecutors used to certain kinds of cases, and defense attorneys, and dozens of people. And what does it come down to? I liken it to when President Obama gets on fucking TV and makes a speech because Congress is fucking with him over a bill, and he says, I want you to call those switchboards at Congress, shut them down, let them know you don't let them work, ruin their day, disrupt the status quo. It's all this is. It's all it is. It is a political form of lobbying that is no different from sit-ins down south in the United States of the 50s or Barack Obama saying, flood the switchboards of the White House. It's no difference. The difference is, as long as those in power use the tool, it's acceptable. Those that are out, when they begin to use it and do it creatively, it's no longer acceptable. You know, Obama should be indicted.
Thank you very much. I think that was a very, very vast picture, and then yeah, very inspiring for my work.
Oh, good.
The whole interview. Yeah.
Good.
Cool. Great. And one question that doesn't really matter to anything. Just do you know if, as you mentioned him, I just wonder, does Sabu do interviews? Would he be part of my PhD research?
Would who?
Sabu.
Sabu?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just.
He's
avoids every.
He is so freaked out.
Mm.
Sabu is a young kid, a Puerto Rican kid from the Lower East Side of Manhattan, who developed some sense of political conscience over the Vieques issue in Puerto Rico. There was a big struggle for decades over the U.S. using the island of Vieques for bombing runs. It was polluting the water, it was an environmental disaster, it was creating cancer. He began to develop some political sense as a young kid. And he began to, he grew up in a tough neighborhood with a different kind of family. It's unfair for me to say they're just heroin dealers. I didn't mean that. But what I'm saying is, they had criminal records for stuff that was different kinds of resistance and activity. So he sort of found safety and comfort in his computer in his bedroom. And he began to develop a political conscience and sense that evolved and grew. I think it took him to places that made him feel good and comfortable and safe, mm-hmm. and it also took him to places that it should not have.
Yeah.
So he became legendary in some respects, but some of it, keep in mind, Anonymous is not about
personal legends.
Right. It's not about hacking to get to embarrass for the sake of embarrassment. It's not about theft of identities. It's not about stealing money.
Yeah.
It's not about using credit card fraud. It's not about personal aggrandizement.
Yeah.
And to some degree, Sabu crossed that road.
Yeah.
He's in the neighborhood. I think he's pretty much shell-shocked. I don't think he'd give an interview for anything.
Yeah. Do you think that it isn't there, that's perhaps another point that I forgot in the interview, isn't there a big temptation to cross this border, also for Mercedes, for example, for people who have even if they pretend not to have, but these spokespositions within Anonymous, they are perhaps as everywhere, again, involved by these power structures that just create new systems of domination, even within this new movement.
There is a tremendous temptation, no matter how much of an anarchist, an independisto, a lone wolf you may be, there is a tremendous temptation to fill voids, to assume responsibility, to take leadership roles, because there are certain people that by their charismatic nature, their skills, and their commitment, are more inclined to do that.
Sure.
So part of the resistance has to be a personal resistance.
Yeah.
It has to make sure, it's one of the demons that the wizard Mercedes has to deal with. She's incredibly charismatic, dynamic, dedicated, and skilled. So she just told me the story about how, last night she, when a group of people led a counter demonstration at the local Democratic machine, the party convention, to undo an issue that had to do with Occupy Las Vegas. They organize signatures, they get out there, they move. I've seen her at Occupy Vegas. Mercedes, what do you think? What do you want to do? So for a movement that is essentially independent and anachronistic and anarchistic, to resist the temptation to embrace the leadership of the mantleship or the mantle of leadership is difficult.
That's what Zapatistas tried to avoid and so on, but then they're still, perhaps you have to create a fictional leader like Subcomandante Marcos, but he is still there.
Well, listen, you get a pipe, you have a pretty horse, and you walk on, and you wink.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things of going back to, Hamas, one of the very fascinating, as an undergraduate, I was a political science major, and my first graduate degree is a master's degree, sort of a combination of political science and social work. So I'm interested in the whole dynamic of politics and organizing as an effective tool. And one of the reasons why Hamas has been as effective and as impenetrable as it has been for as long as it has, gets its power and strength from Islamic tradition, where all people are ultimately equal, is there is a consensus at operation where, although there are firsts among equals, there is truly a project, a work underway where folks, the shura, the leadership council, which is comprised of a shoemaker on the street, or a PhD in university, or a military leader, or a young kid who's in university, have an equal say and an equal role. And people talk, and they debate, and they discuss, they reach a consensus decision that has to be consistent with their Islamic tenets, and they move on. It's one of the reasons it makes the movement so difficult to break, and it's one of the reasons why it's been as successful as it is. That's not to say that there aren't a handful of identified major players. There are. But those major... Look, I've sat in Abu Marzouk's office and seen him welcome 14-year-old to 80-year-olds, people that are playing soccer to people that are retired generals from Fatah, coming to give their opinion, asking questions, looking for advice, getting it. It's the sense of collectivism that ultimately is so critical. In its best of light, that's what Anonymous aspires to do. On the other hand, what makes it difficult is the Islamist resistance movements have an essential, have a core, and that's Islam.
Yeah.
So there is a foundation, a basis, a connection that doesn't exist in the movement Anonymous.
Yeah. It can, if there is a core, it's nihilist in the end.
That's exactly
because
right.
Because it's anti-representational and anti-identity politics, but...
That's exactly right. And there is that temptation. I mean, after the indictment, Anonymous made Mercedes the poster girl for Anonymous. And I said, I don't want this, we can't have this, we can't do it. And, you know, Mercedes is viewed by much of the Anonymous movement in the United States and overseas as, quote, a leader.
Yeah.
And it's the last thing in the world she wants.
Yeah.
It's the last thing in the world I want.
Yeah.
But... We all have our skills. We all have our roles to play. You know, I'm in a courtroom with 15 or 16 very competent, very experienced, very sophisticated, very committed defense attorneys. And to some degree, some of the stuff gravitates or is deferred to me because I'm the most political attorney in the place. And, you know, I have a certain profile and persona and a certain capacity and experience that allows me to deal with these situations. Resistance is resistance. You know, whether it's, you know, fighting the Israelis in the grounds of Gaza, or whether it's fighting in the Silicon Valley, you know, the CIA through an... Resistance is resistance.
It's against those who are in power.
That's exactly right. And, you know, there's armed struggle, there's verbal struggle, there's computer struggle.
Yeah.
There are certain core tenets that transcend. It's another thing that Marx wrote about a long time ago, as you know.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting. I like the case. I like the group of defendants I've seen. The issue is a wonderful issue. And as I said in this discussion I had in Gaza at the House of Wisdom last week with a group of largely students from the Islamic University in Gaza, I said, you know, people were asking me in my opinion, how do you do that? What do you think? And I said, listen, you're the future.
Mm.
You know, I've had my run. All right?
You still run.
Well, I still run, but what I consider the most important thing about those who resist is setting, creating, developing an example modality for those that are to come.
Yeah.
To let people know, you can do this. You can fight this fight. You can walk this walk. It's expensive. It's painful. It's difficult. Be prepared for the government to lie about you and fuck with you and mess with you. It comes with the turf, but it can be done.
Yeah.
And the one thing I've always said to young people all over the world, I have this metaphor, this visual metaphor about young people wanting to become drum majors for mediocrity, where I say, the ultimate sin is to be 20, 25, 30, 35 fucking years old and take a number and join the bus.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're young, it's yours. Go for it. Play an active role. Lead, develop. And as you, you may decide you don't want to do it. One of the things that I remember with such distaste among my own comrades in my 20s and late 20s and 30s, I'd run into them years later, and they sort of, and you say, well, what are you doing, what are you doing? And they're on Wall Street, and they're bank presidents, and, you know, they're doing this, and they're, you know. And the numbers of them that say, would say, oh, I grew up. I got beyond that. And I would say, no, you just sold out.
Yeah.
You quit. I would respect you much more if you simply said, I woke up and decided this is not for me.
Yeah.
But to marginalize or trivialize resistance is sinful.
Yeah.
And I think what's important for we elder statespeople, and it's funny because at this point in my life I've been privileged, I travel a lot, you know, I was in Doha, and you know, Desmond Tutu tapped me on the shoulder and said, hi Stanley, and I said, Desmond Tutu just said, hi Stanley, hi, how are you? So at my age, in your 50s and 60s, you then look up at those in their 70s and 80s and understand that there is an evolution of resistance in all cultures, in all times, in all places. So when I look at the 20 and the 30-year-old anonymous kids, people, I say, cool. It's, you know, it's their turn.
Yeah.
Perfect. That's it.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.